Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello, all theater lovers, both out and proud and on the DL, and welcome to Broadway Breakdown, a podcast discussing the history and legacy of American theater's most exclusive address, Broadway. This is the first of many series devoted to specific artists that have helped shape Broadway as we know it today, both for better and for worse. It is called A Little Sondheim Music, and it is dedicated to the musicals of one, Mr. Stephen Sondheim. I am your host, Matt Koplik, the least famous and most opinionated of all the Broadway podcast hosts. And with me today is a comedian, an artist, a singer. You might have seen them on At Home with Amy Sedaris or on High Maintenance, or you might have seen them on the New York stage in the musical that we're discussing today. It is Aaron Markey. Hello, Aaron.
Hi. Good to see you through this Zoom lens.
This beautiful Zoom lens. I'm assuming that's all natural light that's just shining on your face today, yes?
It is, yeah. I tried to place this strategically for the year.
It's very well placed. It is nature's ring light is what I'm seeing right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, exactly.
Very beautiful. How are you today?
I'm good. I'm not going to talk about the diet app that I'm using right now. That's all I'm going to say about it. But that is where my mind is most of the time.
Okay. Yeah, I said don't bring it up because it's not sponsoring this podcast, so we don't need to give them any of our time.
Nope, absolutely not.
No. And I'm sorry to keep you in on this gorgeous day, but again, the lighting is just, it's prime for you today. So congratulations on the placement of your computer. Aaron, what Sondheim musical are we talking about today?
We're talking about Assassins.
And one might say that you've had some exposure to Assassins. Would that be fair to say?
Briefly, yeah.
Briefly, but very famously. That was a very well-documented production. You did it at New York City Center in the Off-Center Encores series.
Yes. Emphasis on the cores.
On the course. You played One Squeaky Frome.
I did. Mm-hmm.
I saw that production. I was in the front of the mezz, and I recall your scene with one Victoria Clark with Squeaky and Sarah Jane Moore, mm-hmm. which is, I mean, I'm not saying this because you're in front of me. I mean, it helps that you're in front of me, but that's just naturally one of my favorite scenes in all of theater. I just think it's so well written. You guys did it so well. And yeah, congrats on taking a wonderful scene and doing a good job with it.
Thanks. Well, Victoria is very, very fun and easy to work with. And I felt, you know, how sometimes, I don't know if you're a performer or if you've ever performed, but like depending on the chemistry with the person, you can let your intimidation or your bad chemistry just dominate the entire vibe, but she has such good chemistry with everybody that it was very easy.
That's wonderful. Yeah, I used to perform. I'm now sort of in the writing part, but I had a meeting with someone a few months back, and this was someone who was trying to get into writing. It's an example of where you talk about like how chemistry can sort of be off, but this was a guy who had written songs for a long time and wanted to take his songs and make them fit into a plot, which, you know, that's always just the best way to work. And I was like, well, maybe we should meet to sort of see if we have chemistry, if like we get along, if our sensibilities are the same in terms of like what kind of work we want to do. And he just went, because I've been writing songs for 30 years. I've never not gone along with anybody. I was like, it's not about that. It's about if we mesh, if it all goes well together. But he didn't really get that. So that's just an example of where how someone can be talented and yet still doesn't always blend well. So I'm glad that it blended well with Vicky.
Yeah, Vicky is no that guy.
Yes, she's no that guy. I call her Vicky like I know her. I don't know her, but you know, everyone's my friend. As you said, I walk out of the house every day and I'm performing. I'm just always on and it's exhausting, but what can I do? The world is my audience.
Performance studies MFA. You don't need one. You already know what's going on.
Exactly. Was your performance in Assassins, was that your first time being exposed to the show?
Yeah, it actually was. I was really surprised when they didn't make me audition, which was the best email I've ever received. I despise auditions more than most people, I think. I'd like to claim that. I feel like the power dynamic of auditions just already puts me in a position where I'm set up to fail. But mm-hmm. an offer in all capital letters in the subject heading, I mean, that is, you're asking somebody to do their best work.
Absolutely. And it's just, that's just the most glamorous thing I've ever heard. Just email offer in all caps.
I was like, should I just be offer only from now on after this? But that's not how it works.
No, but that's how I sort of, again, I walk out and I perform every day. I live my life like it's always offer only. When I reached out to you, I shouldn't have asked. I should have just been like, hey, Aaron, we've never met before, but you're doing this thing.
No, I mean, just the all capital letters of offer in the subject heading, I would have been like, I'll take it.
Absolutely, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So upon learning the show, because you're a musical person, but I don't know if you're like a musical theater person, like if that's the world that you sort of came up in, is it?
That's the question. No, I didn't come up in musical theater. My dad is like, we were forced and we sort of loved it, forced to listen to Phantom of the Opera every single night at 6 p.m. when he got home, like through his Dolby Digital surround sound.
Forced at 6 p.m. every night, sort of loved it.
Yeah. So in that way, I do come from musical theater. But no, I was not trained in like a musical theater school. I don't even really think of myself as a singer. I just think of myself as somebody who uses their voice because they love to, and it gets incorporated into the work.
Aaron, I don't know how to say this to you lightly, so I'm just going to say it. That's exactly what a singer is.
It's just too much. It's too much pressure.
I hear you. Well, I think especially now people think singers and they think, you know, these like really wide ranges and these like vocal pyrotechnics in American Idol. And like, that's just using an instrument in a different way. But no, what you do is 100% singing. You're a singer. I hate to break it to you. And now having done Assassins, you're in the musical theater world. I'm so sorry.
I'm more of the masked singer kind of.
I've never seen that show, but it won't leave me alone. It just pops up everywhere I go.
I watched the Russian Doll sha-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-lo one.
Wait, was that a sentence? Watch the Russian Doll sha-la-la-la-la?
Yeah, you know that song from A Star is Born with
Gaga? Oh, Shallow. God. I did not even think. I was. You know what I'm thinking? When you said sha-la-la-la-lo, I was thinking, sha-la-la-la-la, la-la-la-la. That's what I was thinking of, Shallow. I mean, Russian Doll singing Shallow.
Happening in music. They weren't the first.
No, they weren't the first, but they did piss all over the competition. That's what Gaga did with Shallow.
I didn't see the third one yet. I'm scared to. The third A Star is Born. I just feel like Judy and Barbara were such perfection. Can Gaga get there? I don't need to know.
It's hard to explain. Technically speaking, it's the fourth one. Because there was a non-musical one in the 30s with Janet Gaynor, but nobody knows about it because she don't sing in it.
Ooh.
Yeah. But I will say, of the, like, Gaga, She does great. She does a really great job. It is a little fun to have them be like, she's no working class. She's from, you know, the bad side of town, and her face doesn't move. She's like, I'm just a poor girl. I can't afford nothing. Meanwhile, she's got $90,000 of Botox in her face, which isn't a judgment on how she looks. It's just, it's that contrast, you know?
Yeah. They should have just superimposed some frames of Frances McDormand from Nomadland over those close-ups.
I need to see that. Have you seen that yet?
Oh, yeah. It's good.
Let's talk assassins.
All right, fine.
If we must. I assume you were aware of one Mr. Stephen Sondheim before you were offered assassins, yes? You were aware that he was a person who existed?
Yes. I was obsessed with Gypsy. Because I took a class, a famously controversial class in college called How to Be Gay. And Gypsy was a huge part of that syllabus.
Interesting. Just like from a pop culture standpoint, because they say it has a queer narrative. Or because Rose, the woman it's based off of in real life, was a lesbian.
Well, we read a book. God, I cannot remember the author. But this awesome essayist wrote a book called A Place for Us, where he used Gypsy as a musical theater allegory to describe like the gay male experience of growing up in a certain time. And it was just devastatingly good. I do recommend it. It's called A Place for Us.
Fascinating. I will read that. I have a similar theory, but it's about The Little Mermaid, the Disney Little Mermaid.
Sure.
But honestly, you could just apply it to anything. I mean, sure. Being a man, legally speaking, I like to apply my story to everything. So I'm like, yeah, you know, Devil Wears Prada, totally my story. Working Girl, my story. Shawshank Redemption, my story.
Centipede, my story.
Centipede, human centipede, my story.
Yeah,
centipede. Human centipede, fun times. So you were aware of Sondheim, you love Gypsy, as right you should. Gypsy's a wonderful musical, but you didn't really know assassins.
Sondheim only wrote the lyrics for Gypsy, right?
Sorry. Yes, he did. Yes. By this point, we will have gone way past Gypsy, but anybody who's interested can go back and listen to the episode. It is the second musical he wrote lyrics for Broadway. His whole like early of his career is kind of weird because like the show that he was supposed to have as his Broadway debut, he was going to write the music and lyrics for, and the producer died. That show is called Saturday Night, and it finally came to New York in 2000 after like his whole career. And everybody's like, oh, what's this new show? He's like, well, it's not really new. It's the first one I ever wrote. It's just, you know, 40 years later. And then got West Side Story from that. And then he was supposed to do Forum, but Forum was taking too long, and then did Gypsy. So by the time Forum came out, everyone's like, what makes you think you can write music? He's like, I kind of always have been, just people keep asking me to do the lyrics.
And then if you're really sassy, you can just be like, well, words are music.
Yeah. I don't think that's sassy. That's just damn poetry right there.
Thank you.
Did you come up with that on the spot? Is that all you?
Yeah, I would say.
Fantastic. So if you'll indulge me for a second, Aaron, I'm going to give us a little bit of backstory about how we got assassins, how it sort of came to be. And then we'll sort of dive into the show and we'll see what you and I both remember and know and understand. And it'll be
right approach.
Exactly. It'll be a nice little something, something. So Assassins comes right after Into the Woods, which as a performer, I'm assuming you are aware of Into the Woods.
Obsessed.
Yes. Aren't we all? That is like the performer Sondheim musical. So at this point, Sondheim now has 6 Tony Awards, I believe 6 Grammys, ooh, and a Pulitzer. He's on his way to winning an Oscar for the movie Dick Tracy. So similar to when he had Sweeney Todd and he kind of needed a little bit of a speed bump, Assassins, when it came out, was sort of like his next speed bump. He was looking for something to collaborate with John Wideman on. They had done a musical called Pacific Overtures together, which is about the westernization of Japan in the 1800s. And, you know, like you do. And they were looking for things to write about, and Sondheim remembered a script he had read in 1979, I believe. He was on the panel for some like young artist workshop whatever, and read a script for a potential musical by Charles Gilbert Jr., and it was called Assassins. And it was about a Vietnam vet who went on to become a presidential assassin. And Sondheim was like, I don't really like the script, but I really like the title and the general idea of writing about assassins. So like 10 years later, he says to Weidman, he's like, oh, you know, this, I remember the script I read called Assassins. And Weidman's like, yes, how do we get it? He's like, can we just like steal the title and the concept? So they call up the playwright who thinks that like Sondheim wants to produce his musical after all these years. And Sondheim's like, no, you misunderstood. I don't like anything you wrote. I just like the idea you have.
Wow.
I'm sure he was nicer than that, but can you imagine, right. Like, imagine that email you got, Aaron, with offer only in caps and all caps, and like, we don't want you or anything you do, but we're offering you the chance to just stand over to the side while we do something.
That's kind of a good offer still.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, as long as it's an offer. An offer is an offer, an offer. Apparently the opening scene in the script was a shooting gallery, and Sondheim was like, that's a great opening image, especially for, you know, assassins. So they steal that as well. Not steal. They tell him, these are the things we'd like to use. We like to take your title, and we like to take the shooting gallery, and we'll write everything else new.
Because they actually optioned the play?
No, I don't. Legally speaking, I don't know exactly what happened. I think it's just that the play, like, the play didn't have any kind of representation. It was just, you know, a script that was written, and Sondheim and Weidman wanted the title and they wanted the opening image, and so that way they could avoid being sued, they reached out to the playwright and they were like, we don't want to do your play, we just like your title and we like your opening image. If we promise that nothing else will resemble what you've written, can we do it? And he's like, yeah, as long as, you know, nobody, like, if somebody wants to do my play, you can't like bar them from doing it because you're writing it. And they're like, no, absolutely, and I don't think that problem ever arose. Right. So yeah, I mean, Charles Gilbert Jr. who. So they go about writing the show, and they do a production at Playwrights Horizons in 1991, I believe. Mm-hmm. Yes. Opens in January of 91. The whole concept of the show, of it being sort of like a vaudeville review, came about because they were like, originally it was going to be a history of assassins, and it was going to be like the world of assassins. And they're like, well, sadly that's too long of a show because we've had so many of them over the years, and they go, okay, how about just in, you know, the last like century or two centuries? And then they go, even that's too much. They go, okay, we'll just make it America. And they go, wow, even that's too much, we'll just make it presidential assassins. And that's sort of how they're able to narrow it down. And Weidman was like, I just got bored writing like, and then this happened. I was like, can I have this assassins interact with each other? Can I have like screwiness with timelines? And they went for it. And I, from what I understand, Weidman basically wrote the script as it is today. Sondheim read it and he's like, great, I'll find the songs I want to use. And he like doesn't change anything. It opens a Playwrights Horizons with Victor Garber and Annie Golden and Terrence Mann and Deborah Monk and my personal favorite, Eddie Corbitch. And it was going to be a big Broadway transfer, but all the reviews were like, no. Yeah, it came out right in the middle of the Persian Gulf War, and everyone was sort of like, not the time, guys. Not the time.
Right.
Yeah. And we'll go into how that all unfolds after we talk about the show, when we get into the legacy of assassins. So that was actually probably the shortest history I've ever given on a show in this series.
I feel honored.
You're very welcome. Well, like, you know, unlike, say, Follies, which took, you know, almost 10 years to get to Broadway. Sweeney Todd took a few years. Merrily had a very troubled preview process. This was all like pretty smooth. They had the idea, they started writing it, they put it up a year later. Not a ton of people liked it, but they were like, well, we do.
It has to go to Broadway,
but Sondheim. But alas, it does not. This is like the first time a Sondheim show that like had all this press did not end up on Broadway, which is fine. It does come to Broadway later. We'll discuss it. But yeah, like really the true like story, I guess you could say, comes after the fact. The like getting it produced was not the ticket. That was not the story. The real story is like what happens after. But we'll get to that once we talk about the show. So the show. How would you describe what the show's about, Aaron?
Oh gosh. I'm sorry. I should put this on silent. Oh my
God. Very rude. I'm gonna eat my lunch now because I thought that we were holding some decorum during this interview, and now that I know that's out the window.
Do your worst. I don't know. I mean, it's a show about like the where and how in the gut the impulse to like choose to inflict violence on a huge government celebrity comes from.
Yeah, that is definitely it on a thematic level. For the basics out there, for all of you lovely basic babies, it is a dreamlike vaudeville chronicling all of the major presidential assassins in America, those that have been successful and those that have not, right. Starting with John Wilkes Booth and, you know, ending with what's his face? Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yeah.
I was going to call him John Benjamin Hickey. I was like, that's not it at all.
No.
But we have others like Squeaky Frome and Sarah Jane Moore. And it's weirdly very funny and very moving, but also kind of bizarre. And yeah, when you were working on the show, what was like your first thought when you were kind of looking over the material? How did it hit you?
Well, it hit me in a very musical theater way, I'll say that. And I was like, a little bit of me was like, I don't know. I don't know if I feel like going down this road right now. But I'm so lucky that I did go down the road. Because once you're inside of it, you don't have the critical eye anymore. You have the like, get her done eye. And that we're, I'm so proud of us eye. So it's a really hard, it's hard music.
Yeah.
So it was... Yeah, so it was difficult to learn together as an ensemble. A couple of the like more ensemble-y songs in the beginning and the end. I can't even remember. Another national anthem.
I was gonna say another national anthem is probably the hardest song in that show to learn as an ensemble. Everybody's Got the Right is pretty.
Yeah, that one's pretty easy.
Yeah, and is it? I mean, I also just really love the song. Like it starts off so like weirdly sinister, and it's very, you know, the what's his name? The Executioner, is that his name? No.
No, there's the balladeer and the
what? It's the balladeer and somebody.
Proprietor,
yes. I'm trying to say executioner. The proprietor. When he begins the song with the hey, buddy, da, 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 come up and kill the president. It's very devil's inviting you to hell kind of thing. It's very seductive, very odd and dissonant. And then it goes into the like jaunty little musical theater tune, and that's when I kind of sit there and I tap my toes. I'm like, I'm tapping my toes for a bunch of people who are about to shoot people. That's turning the tables on me. So I guess what we're saying here is that I'm a basic musical theater person, so I'm looking at this material, I'm like, oh my god, so odd and weird. And we've got Aaron here who's like, you don't know weird. Sitting in your little castle.
Well, that music, that melody that you just sang is actually like super weird and difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, there's lots of like weird melodic phrases that are like chef's kiss to Sondheim that I was super excited to crawl inside of and listen to over and over. And I'm putting that in quotes because it was a 5-night run.
Yeah. How long did you guys have to rehearse? A week? 2 weeks?
10 days.
Okay.
Or maybe that included all the show dates too. No, it couldn't have. Yeah. I think 10 days.
Yeah, 10 days. Okay. I mean, definitely not a lot of time, but you got it done. So that's insane and amazing. Yeah, that's wonderful. Was there a moment when see what?
No, go ahead.
Go ahead. Did you guys like have a moment collectively as a unit when it all sort of felt like it came together, or was it just a little too much of like kind of chaos that you didn't realize that it was together until you took your final bow?
It certainly felt insane, like right up to the first night we opened, but by the like final night, it felt pretty as much in the pocket as it could.
Yeah. I was
even the fact that we were holding binders for another national anthem.
Yes. Well, you could have to. I
mean, we really had to. It was insane. And my head was in the book. I was like, I'm going to trip over this cape.
I mean, so something I was reading about with a lot of Sondheim shows with Company, the first time that was put on, because that was like mostly actors who kind of sang.
Yeah.
And didn't have any really musical training. And that show, you know, the opening of Company is essentially like a more Broadway-y version of National Anthem where everyone's singing various different things. Right. And it took them a full day just to learn the first two pages. So
yeah,
that's them. So of course you guys need, if you guys have 10 days to do the whole show, get it up and running, like, yeah, you're going to get binders for another National Anthem. That's just, you know, being aware that your actors are human beings.
It's the other national anthem saying, if you want to hear, it says
bullshit.
It says never. It says sorry.
Loud and clear.
It says listen to the tune that keeps sounding in the distance on the outside coming through the crowd.
To the hearts that go on pounding to the sound, getting louder every year. Sound.
Take a look around.
What would you say is your favorite song with Assassins? Would it be the one that you sang? Are you that kind of person?
I mean, that's the one I'm most intimate with, obviously. So sure, it's like in my body. I was just re-listening to that song, I don't know, like 20 minutes before we started talking. And I got like the same little chills. I was listening to Annie Golden's version and I got the same chills that I had on stage, because I just remember like the terror and the triumph of doing that to like a house of 3,000 people, and like knowing
that everyone in that house knew the words.
Yeah. And like how far you had to fall if you fucked it up.
Yeah. It's.
And.
No, you said and.
I'll frame it negative. I was about to add a positive, but you don't have to. You don't have to add.
No, you don't have to end on a positive every time. Looking back, knowing now what I know about you and your journey with this show, it was kind of, it's amazing and it's great that you succeeded, but it is sort of mean to like put you out on a stage with so little time to prepare on a show where everyone in that audience knows the show probably better than you did. And we'll judge based off of like, well, let's see if they know all the words. Let's see how well they hit the notes. And then to do it and triumph in it, it's sort of like, you know, you walk off stage and you go, I pissed all over that.
Well, I wasn't the only downtown weirdo in that cast. Like,
who else was the downtown weirdo on that cast?
Danny Woolahan at the time. Now he's done, he was just in West Side Story. And then before that, he did To Kill a Mockingbird.
So right? Assassins then, corrupted him then, made him become a Broadway kid.
I think so. And then Ethan Lipton, who played the proprietor.
Ah, huh. Now I'm trying to remember, because again, basic bitch that I am, I'm like, Victoria Clark, Stephen Pasquale, Alan Spiderman, Stephen Boyer. Like, what are you talking about? Those are all Broadway people. But now I'm like, oh, I guess there are other people that I completely forgot about. Ethan Lipton, proprietor. John Ellison Conley, that's a Broadway man. Shuler Hensley, Broadway man.
Sure.
Danny Woolahan. Samuel Bick. Okay, yeah, no, that would do it. That would do it. That would do it.
Yeah,
that would do it. You're absolutely right, although... So when you, did you go to see him in To Kill a Mockingbird? And did you say afterwards, you sold out, man?
No, but I saw him on Instagram all the way through.
And did you troll him all the way?
Does an audition for the tour of To Kill a Mockingbird count as seeing Danny in the Broadway version?
Sure. I mean, I didn't see him in either version, but I did see it. And then I did think about reading the book To Kill a Mockingbird, but...
Oh yeah,
that's, you know,
smart.
So I guess what I wanted to ask you with, so your favorite song is the one you sang, Unworthy of Your Love.
I don't know if it's my favorite. It's just the most memorable. And because we're 4 years out, sure, it's my favorite.
Sure, sure. So let's give some context to Unworthy of Your Love. It is the song that Squeaky Frum sings.
With John Hinckley.
John Hinckley. And you're singing to someone named Charles Manson. He's pretty known. Currently famous from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. For those of you who don't want to crack open a history book. Mm. But he is singing to Jodie Foster. So one could say it's this beautiful love song with creepy targets.
Which, I mean, awesomely, like, I wish that I had been singing to Jodie Foster. So it was a cool, because it was a duet, it was a cool way to triangulate the desire. Because Charles Manson doesn't really do it for me, but I had to figure it out.
Yeah. As a performer, you're like, I have to get into this character. I got to figure out how to make it work for me. So, yeah, have Jodie Foster on that stage. You could just sing to her.
I am unworthy of your
I think what also helps is, and this is me getting all analytical, but the Jody that John is singing to and the Charlie that Squeaky is singing to don't really exist. They're the people that they put up in their own minds. So it's not like you have to base your attitude of the song in this like grounded reality. They're both sort of in this fantasy space. So imagining someone else instead of Charles Manson.
Squeaky knew Charles Manson.
Yes, I know she knew him, but I'm saying that the man that she has in her brain is not really who Charles Manson was. She has a warped vision of him, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but I mean, that could be true for any of us about any of the others of us. Just because she's in a she's not psychotic anymore, but she made a couple wrong choices, okay?
She was in a vulnerable state when he came in and was able to find his way through. That is the most simplistic, kindest way I can think of it.
I blame Charles Manson for all presidential assassinations, actually.
Even the ones before he was born?
Definitely.
Yeah, I think that's the wisest thing to do.
Yeah.
thinking about Jodie Foster, did you have any, like, what are your takeaways from doing that song? As you listen to it again, as your body sort of remembers it, what are your takeaways of Unworthy of Your Love?
Well, you know, the song is like, it's about humility on some level, like really humbling yourself for your object of desire. And to sort of like believably perform humility, it's very much not to get all namaste, but like it's a heart opening exercise. And because of the structure of New York City Center, where those balconies are so tall, it is begging you to do a heart opener. So it was like, the content of the song plus the space of that theater were just like psoriasis curing.
I'm gonna take what you just said and just apply that purely to Unworthy of Your Love.
Yeah.
Aaron Markey says Unworthy of Your Love, psoriasis curing. Yeah. I don't know how to be humble. I don't even know where to start. So I don't think I could ever sing that song. I would get into it. I'm like,
start by singing that song. You should start by singing that song.
And then I'll go, oh no, I've learned humility within the first four bars. With the balladeer and all of the ballads of the assassins, there are only three ballads, and they are all about the assassins that are successful. Booth, Guito, and I don't know how to say the third one. Schlaglage. Cholgosh.
Oh, yeah, Cholgosh. Yeah.
Cholgosh. Oh, ninth time.
I don't know if that's how you pronounce it, but yes, I'm just agreeing with you. Yep, that sounds like his name-ish.
Yeah, those are that's his name-ish. Those are the three songs in the show for me that are the most like Americana, very have a lot of like Sousa elements to them, or Ballad of Booth, I say, like has a lot of sort of Big River vibes, because you know it's meant to sort of evoke the old South, for whatever that means. And while I like them melodically speaking, it's more songs like Unworthy of Your Love and Another National Anthem and Something Just Broke that I listen to more on repeat. I feel like I have more admiration for the ballads in terms of songwriting and storytelling than I do in terms of pure enjoyment. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, they're poppier. They're more like, or like the what did you say, Unworthy of Your Love, and what were the
Unworthy of Your Love is really the poppy one, but also Another National Anthem and Something Just Broke, like those are the three songs that I listen to most.
Yeah, Another National Anthem is not poppy, but there's,
I don't know, I think it pops.
Style. who sang the other one?
Oh, I don't think you guys did Something Just Broke in your production. This is actually a good thing to get into. So, you guys did, I believe, the original off-Broadway version. And then you said you were listening to the cast recording with Annie Golden, so it wouldn't be on there.
Yeah.
Something Just Broke was a song that was written for Assassins the year after it opened in New York, because it was done in London at the Donmar Warehouse, directed by Sam Mendes. And he was, you know, while he was getting ready to put it up, he was telling Sondheim and Weidman, like, I feel like there's a song missing towards the end after Another National Anthem. Like, you have Another National Anthem, you have a really long scene at the library, and there needs to be just one more song before we go into Everybody's Got the Right.
No, maybe we did sing that, maybe I'm just forgetting.
So Something Just Broke isn't sung by the Assassins, it's sung by the ensemble.
Yes. That was in there. That's why I don't remember it.
Oh, but you guys did do it then. Okay. Yeah,
we did. We did.
Okay. So yeah, it was basically what happened was everybody thinks that it was Sam Mendes was like, we need a song to soften the show. But what happened was all Mendes said was like, I feel like there needs one more song. Like there's something missing. And Weidman went to the Depository, where it's now sort of become a museum, and they have these videos where people talk about where they were when they found out Kennedy was shot. And Weidman's like, oh, that's a song. And like, we don't really have anything from the perspective of the people. It's all within the worldview of the Assassins. The only song that sort of comes from the people is How I Saved Roosevelt, which is more of like a mocking kind of song. And there are some people who are Assassins purists who love the show without it. They're like, it adds nothing. It's trying to make the show have emotion, and there's no emotion in this show, and that's why I like it. And I'm someone who thinks that the song is actually quite necessary. This is the only Sondheim show where he adds a song after the fact, and I think it's an improvement. He has a couple other shows where he changes things. Merrily We Roll Along obviously has had many changes over the years. He did a production of Follies where he was asked to write new songs, and I don't like any of them. This is the only one where I'm like, I like the new song.
I mean, he was crying.
He was crying.
She was crying.
I'll remember it forever.
And I thought,
the president's been shot.
You know what? There are presidents who aren't worth a lot.
I kept thinking,
there's the kind that gets elected then forgot.
Mr. Garfield,
Mr. Lincoln, he's a hack.
Bill McKinley,
he's a giant.
He's a joke.
Still, something just broke.
I don't know. I feel like it just adds a gravitas to the show that it doesn't normally have, because the show is so conceptual up until that point. And that's the song that reminds you, like, what these people have done with their lives and the actions that they've taken has consequences on millions. And this sort of emotional potency that I feel like without it, the show lacks. So I like that it's there.
But don't you think that, like, the Assassins profiles are in counterpoint to, like, we already know that everybody was affected by the assassinations of these presidents because we are that song. Like, that's what the audience is.
Yeah, but I think it's easy to forget because we are so wrapped up in the rest of the show. So I maybe that's also why I find it effective, because it is the one song where I'm like, that's us. Like, that's where we get to be heard for a second. And it's only for the 3 minutes of that song, and it's only until the very, very end. They really, like, hold off on it until the very end, which I think is very clever of them.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's one of those things where it's just, like, it's very emotionally compelling to me, and I'm sure you could argue against it and for it, but I just know that the reaction that I get whenever I listen to it is one where I'm like, this fits, and this has felt like a necessary moment for me to just sort of sit in this before we finish out the show. And yeah. I don't think that the show is trying to be sappy with it, because if it were, it would close out with that and not with a reprise of Everybody's Got the Right.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't identify with any of those normies. I'm more with the assassins.
Well, I think what I can identify with the assassins is something that's a theme in a lot of Sondheim shows. Speaking of Gypsy, Assassins kind of takes the same theme, which is that, you know, everybody just sort of wants to be noticed. Everybody wants to have their voice heard. And, you know, to bring it back to that last song, something's going to break if some people get ignored or downtrodden for too long. We all have a tipping point. And yeah. It's about sort of finding the connecting tissue with all those people and trying to find a way to connect it to us. And I don't know, I think Something Just Broke is just a nice sort of moment for the audience to breathe and totally. Yeah. And reflect on all of it.
Have a cigarette. Totally. I'm actually just being a, like, contrarian.
No, I love it.
Without really remembering, like, the heart and soul of the song.
Be fair, you were off stage and were probably just like, okay, what are the lyrics for the next song? We learned this 2 days ago.
Exactly.
It was your moment. That was your moment to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
I do like how I'm like, yeah, it's a good moment for the audience to breathe. And you're like, yeah, it's a good moment for them to leave the theater and have a cigarette.
Well, I meant that, like, breathing is smoking a cigarette.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a decompression. I don't know. I like it. And if I had clearer thoughts, if I wasn't, like, just coming off of work right now, I think I would have had, like, a nice written statement for you where I could.
I'm so curious about what your job is.
It's nothing special. I work at a private equity firm where my job is essentially to, like, make sure that everybody has everything they need. And luckily I only have to be there for, like, a couple of hours a day. I'm only there till 2. But it's like, you know, I get to sit and I can write for a while. And then after an hour, someone's like, can you measure the wall in my office to see if I can put a painting up there? Can you see if the coffee machine's running?
Can you do it? I think you can.
I think you can. Like, or maybe you just don't come into work today because we're in the middle of a pandemic. Thank you so much. like, my job requires me to go in there, and everyone else, I'm like, you can do your job from home. We've learned this. So maybe just work from home. But I guess they want to put on pants, which I do not share those feelings.
And, like, get away from their children, I'm sure.
That I fully understand.
Mm-hmm.
The putting on pants in public thing, I can't relate to. I have to put on pants to be in public, but right. Getting away from children, totally understand.
I know. I feel like I've spent my entire life not having children to get away from children.
Sounds to me, Erin, that you live
I was fertile as an infant.
You what?
I was fertile as an infant.
But you have chosen the best life.
I have. No, I do know that every day. Sure, babies are cute. I love holding them. But I don't want to hold them for 2 years and then watch them turn into jerks.
Yeah. It's the equivalent to me of visiting Disney World and living at Disney World.
Like, yeah.
Or, like, working at Disney World, you know? Like, I want to go to Disney World for a week as a visitor. I don't want to work there and see how the sausage gets made.
Exactly.
I'll be a great gunkle. I'll be a great godfather.
I'll buy the Halloween costumes.
Exactly. You know, I'm the Auntie Mame who comes in and I'm like, here's your Halloween costume, kid. Now take a shot of bourbon with me. Ho ho.
See you after you get back from boarding school.
I'll see you in 15 years when you're back from boarding school. Let me know if any of your friends when you're 18 are hot. Was it that quote from Sex and City? Oh, when Samantha on Sex and City won't interact with Brady, Miranda's child, and she's like, how about this? When he's 19, I'll take him out for drinks and flirt with his friends. And I'm like, that is the best way to be a friend.
Yeah, it really is.
She's the one character that gets to stay, in my opinion. I think Samantha would have a similar thought, though, about assassins. She'd be like, what's with this ballad at the end of the show? I want to get back to the assassins. I don't know. That Guito seemed pretty hot to me. Let's get to his ballad again. Oh, honey, assassinate me in the bedroom. That's my Kim Cattrall, everybody.
It's really good. Maybe you should see if they'll let you be the fourth.
Yeah, because she's not doing it. Have me come in. Have some diverse. I think my interpretation of Samantha is just it's my interpretation of Alana Glazer's interpretation of Samantha Jones.
I think that's good enough. If the dots are connected securely enough, then it's fine.
Absolutely. This all came about by going about the ballads, which then led into Something Just Broke. We didn't even really talk about the ballads. Did you get a chance to like listen to those songs, The Ballad of Booth and Guito, when you were learning the show? Or was it like as soon as they were working on something else, you're like, great, I'm going to the other room to work on my stuff?
Oh, we weren't called unless it was like, you know, I'm not in any of those other scenes, just like the ones that I'm in. So
yeah,
I only really saw them when we started putting the show together on stage.
Okay. So you got to watch.
Which was a pleasure. I thought like, you know, everybody was killing their song. And the good thing about this show is that like everybody gets one song, so you can really, really kill it.
Mm-hmm. So when you were watching these songs, and it was more sort of like a, this is an interesting little ditty, and this person that I'm starting to get to know while rehearsing this thing is really killing it.
Yep.
Very much from a performer perspective, not from a, the themes of this song are really getting into my brainiac here.
Well, I really had to make a choice not to be too clever in my commentary about the show, because I thought it would take my body out of the show.
Got it.
Just as a strategy of making it work.
Sure. Well, so then what was your, do you remember anything about sort of your approach to Squeaky? And especially, actually, no, what I really want to get into is the scene with Sarah Jane Moore, with one Vicky Clark. What was your way into it? Because as I said earlier, it's one of my favorite scenes in all of musical theater. I just think it's so well written, and it's funny in a show where like no one ever thinks of assassins as funny until they watch them. Like, oh, this is funny. So I don't know. Yeah, just talk to me. Tell me all.
I mean, it was so. I only really remember what was challenging for me about that scene, which was just sort of like really feeling the monologue that's inside of it about Charles Manson, because it was so, like I said, like easy to work with Vicky. So it was like one of those things where it's not like the scene is not incredibly memorable. It just pinged and snapped.
Well, fuck my drag then, because I think it's incredibly memorable. Aaron just puked all over my thinking.
I don't mean that it's not memorable in a bad way. I mean that it, like, I have the gross kind of personality where if there's ease, then I can let it go. Mm. And if there's difficulty, then I'll just hold on to it for the rest of my life. And not to bring this up again, but it becomes psoriasis.
Got it. Well, so how about this? Assassins is psoriasis, and somehow it manages to cure it for some, and it just exacerbates for others.
Yeah, it cured mine. Get the assassin's tip.
I totally enjoy assassins, which is probably why I've never had psoriasis. Just
yes,
silky skin fine. Forever. I don't think it's a coincidence since once I got into assassins around 15, that's when my acne cleared up. That's when my body got snatched. I was like, look at me.
Everybody's got the right to some sunshine. the sun, but maybe one of his beans.
One of his beans.
Rich man, poor man, black or white, pick your apple, take a bite. Everybody just hold tight to your dream.
I guess the place that I was coming from was that, like, of all the assassins, those were the two women, and I really wanted to make sure that I was as nuanced and present as possible in every beat, because it is my agenda in life to make sure that everybody knows that every relationship between any kind of person is very complicated and full, which is not what the media would present to you historically.
So you're telling me that Notting Hill is a lie and that love is not that simple?
I never saw it. But I immediately thought Hugh Grant, and I immediately thought The Undoing, and that, I will say,
is much more accurate of what a relationship is.
Is the best worst ending of 2020.
Oh my God. Yeah. I think few things have brought this country together than everyone collectively agreeing that The Undoing started so well and ended so poorly.
I know. And all while we were watching Nexium, the, what was that documentary called now? I was obsessed with it and now I can't even remember the name of it. Nexium, the cult, The Vow, the show The Vow.
I didn't see that. Where's that?
Oh, God, you gotta watch it. I have a hunch about why you didn't care about The Vow.
I didn't even hear about it.
What?
I don't even know what that is. What is it? Who is she? What's she about?
The Vow is a series about Keith Raniere, who may as well be an assassin. He was like a although it's a different horse. Who's a cult leader of something. Of a cult called Nexium, spelled not the way it sounds. And I don't know, he like groomed women to like be in his cult so he could like eat them out. And I can't even remember now. I guess what I'm learning is I have Alzheimer's.
I guess so. Wait, was this the cult that that actress from Smallville was in?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
I knew about the cult. I didn't know that they made a documentary. Okay. I have to find this then.
They've made two now, and there's going to be a second season to one of them.
So we're getting so off topic, but I don't fucking care.
No,
but when you said it's not spelled the way it sounds, there's a movie that back when I was an actor auditioning, there was a movie called Band Slam that I had auditioned for, and it's about this like, you know, nerdy kid who moves from one suburb to another suburb, I think then to Jersey with his mom, single mom, Lisa Kudrow. And he gets involved with a group of kids that have a band, one of whom is a girl with a stutter who's like very alternative, played by Vanessa Hudgens. And her name is Sam, but she puts a 5 in between the A and the M. The 5 is silent. And just very, like, not trying to like shit on this movie because I didn't see the finished product, so I don't know how it turned out, but I just remember reading the script and being like, this seems like The Fault in Our Stars is version of the like pixie dream girl if she were goth. And it's just so.
But they're super self-serious about the 5. And
I mean, I don't think they're saying everyone's going like, oh my God, that's the most amazing thing ever. I think it's supposed to be weird, but. Uh-huh. It's very Jughead, I'm a weirdo, I don't fit in, weird, weird, weird thing. And it's like, I think that they thought it was cooler than it was. I don't think they thought it was, you know, mind-blowing, but the girl does, Vanessa Hudgens does, like, it becomes a trend at the end of the movie, and other girls in the school are like, I'm putting a 5 in my name, it's silent. Oh, like,
if I saw the name Sam with a 5 in the middle, I would pronounce it Sazam.
Slam. To be fair, when you're in high school, we all do things that we think are super cool that are not that are not it. I thought I had an extra lock for my locker and I would put it through my belt loop. And I thought that that was a fashion statement. It wasn't. I just had a lock on me. It was my own little chastity belt.
Don't forget the combo.
I think I always had it on me because I was like, I don't want this lock on me forever. So I was like always mentally thinking about it. And after a month, I was like, I'm done with the lock. It's too much work.
There are no accidents.
There are no accidents. Much like assassins, simply just no accidents. But I guess the reason why the reason why I brought up all the stuff with Squeaky and Sarah Jane, in addition to the fact that I just think that the scenes are well done, they are really the only scenes in the show. I should say Squeaky's the one who has scenes with other people, and they're like scenes of people. You know what I mean? They're not these sort of abstract images.
Right.
She has like full on interactions with tension and confusion and all the messiness of life. And that's sort of, other than Something Just Broke, that maybe that's why you don't relate to Something Just Broke as much, because Squeaky scenes are all the ones that have the messiness of human life and emotions in there. And you're like, I already did that.
Yeah, really humane. Like, she seemed like a three-dimensional person to me for sure.
Yeah.
And of all the people, I don't know. I don't know. But like, because you sort of understood her assassination attempt to be like a product of her getting involved in a cult without, mm-hmm. you know, like full agency, like she's sort of like a victim and an aggressor at the same time, which you could make that argument for everybody. And I feel like that's what the show tries mm-hmm. to do, but my body wasn't playing everybody else. So again, back to the body, right?
Well, I'll say that's where you and I differ, because my body plays everybody. that's actually very fair. And it was that you reminded me of a point that I did want to make, and I didn't write it down, which is why I forgot about it, because I'm a stupid bitch. She's the only one whose assassination attempt is a reaction to another person, of wanting to do something for another person, not purely selfish means. Whereas everybody else, while yes, they are both a victim and an aggressor, their assassination attempts stem from a very personal and, for lack of a better term, selfish place. It's how the person that they're trying to kill has affected them, or how they're trying to lash out personally at that system. And Squeaky's more sort of like an accomplice to what she thinks is a greater good. And I think it's what makes her such a fascinating character in this lineup. Whereas, you know, Booth is quote unquote a patriot who's, you know, trying to do right by a country that's being ruined by what he thinks is Lincoln, and other people are lashing out, like Guido, who has stomach pains and has no job, and Chalgosh, I'm gonna say his name differently every time just to see if it eventually sticks, who is trying to lash out at what he thinks is an oppressive system. He's not wrong, but yeah, it's interesting to see when you look at sort of all of these characters, how they all have a lot of things in common. But Squeaky does sort of, or should we call her Lynette, just sort of out of respect?
She is still alive, so why not?
Why not? It is Lynette, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. Lynette, she's the only one in that whole lineup where it's not necessarily what the president has done to her, what the system has done to her, but rather what this other person has informed her of, and then what she's trying to do for that person.
Yeah, which I, you know, now that we're laying it out like this, I don't feel more sympathetic to her than I do any of the other people. Because I'm like, yeah, the system, there's something about radicalism where you take it to the level of being like, I hate this person. I don't believe in what they're doing, so I'm going to shoot them. Like, there's something about that that I can sort of respect.
Yeah.
And like,
I think this is the episode that shuts down the podcast, by the way. I think the government's going to hear this and be like, shut it down.
I know. I'm like, just own it. Like, listen, I'm scared of guns. I would never mm-hmm. do that. My partner has her grandma's Beretta. I shouldn't say this. All right. Never mind.
We don't know where you guys are. So is
yeah,
say,
you're right.
Say what you feel. Say what you feel. Say what's in your heart.
Okay. She has her grandmother's Beretta. I took it out of its little beautiful box. A Beretta is in a small Italian pistol. Mm-hmm. I don't think that there's ammunition in it. I didn't try and see, but just holding a real gun in my hand. It was similar to the moment in Assassins when they like gave us, we had to do all this like training and stuff with the like stage guns, because some of them were real like antiques of like guns that they had to get, and mine was just like this weird heavy stupid like fully, I was like out of a mold, but it still felt insane. It felt like I was holding a weapon
yeah. Of
mass destruction.
There's have you ever watched BoJack Horseman?
A little bit. Okay. First couple episodes.
Yeah, it's I always tell people if they're gonna watch it, they have to get through the first season, because the whole premise of the show does change after a while. It stops being, I mean, it's still a laceration of Hollywood, but it goes into depression and all this other stuff. Anyway, the Alison Brie character, Diane, at one point, she gets hold of a gun, and she's like super, super liberal socialist. And she gets a gun and she thinks she's going to hate it. And also she's like, it is weirdly empowering. And like, it changes your whole body when you have it in your hand.
Well, yeah, the position that your body has to take to take aim,
mm-hmm.
That's like a fucking ancient, like, warrior-like position. If you're really playing it for keeps, which on stage you are. Like, yeah. There's a lot of sloppy gun holds, I'm sure, that work just as well to kill people as, like, super warrior-like ones.
Absolutely.
But we were going for arm length.
Yeah, I think, though... So when you were saying earlier, I think, yeah, what the show is trying to say is like, there's not that much different between these people we see on stage who we have villainized over history and ourselves. There's like, there's a line that they eventually crossed, but what led them there isn't very different from a lot of the grievances that we've all had.
Yeah, and that the presidents have had, you know, that's another form of radicalism, deciding that you're going to be president of the United States of America. Mm-hmm. That is insane. Who even wants that job?
It's the most glamorous, awful job in the world.
Yeah.
It's so glamorous, and it's the worst job you could possibly have.
Like, you have to remove yourself entirely from, like, being an ethics queen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not it. Not a cute look right now.
No. What's also interesting with each of these characters, obviously, you know, nobody thinks that they're the villain in a story. They think they're the hero in the story, right? Like, we're all the protagonist in our movie, right? Which is why social media has been the worst thing to ever happen to humanity, because with this platform, everyone goes, oh, like, there's literally an audience out there now for the movie of my life. Everything I do now can truly be importante, which, not to drag people in my life, but as we're recording this, it's sort of like the anniversary of when like Broadway shut down, and you know, which is a sad ordeal, but the things that I've seen on social media today from people who I know, like, these are human beings who I've chosen to be my friends, with these like posed photos in front of theaters, in Times Square, in front of a poster, with like these long 9-paragraph captions about sort of the feelings they're having. And as somebody who literally just has a podcast to be like, look at me, look at me, look at me, it's, for me, it's just more, it's not a judgment. It's just game recognized game. Like, it's fine to, you know, have that kind of selfish, I want to be noticed, I want everyone to know what I have to say in this moment, but like, you know, just be a little more transparent about it. And that's sort of the thing with Assassins that I feel like, where the show makes it clear that they are not endorsing these characters, because the show is making clear, like, these people think that they're the heroes of their stories, and it's our job to sort of understand that while also then seeing why they're also wrong. Does that make sense? Did I make an actual coherent point? I don't think I did.
No, I think you did. I think you did. And that made me think of, like, maybe that's the difference between Squeaky and some of the other characters, is that, like, I don't think she thinks that what she did was, like, heroic, actually. I think she just was, like, doing it.
Yeah. Maybe she thought it was heroic in the sense of, again, the idea of a greater good. But again, whereas everyone is like, I matter, I need to be heard, at least in regards to how she's portrayed in the show. Her view is, you know, Charlie needs to be heard. Charlie's important. Right. And
which is a way to like triangulate that narrative, to like project like a dude, a dominating dude's like agenda onto your own body by being like adjacent to it.
Yes. Yeah. I also should say I've heard triangulate 3 times in my entire life, and 2 of those times were today during this episode.
Ann Carson book, my friend. Read Ann Carson.
Ann Carson. It's on my wish list. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like we've were able to kind of cover the show pretty decently. Any other things that kind of like stick out to you that while you were re-listening to it, while listening to the songs?
Well, I wanted to talk about the psoriasis song in Act 2.
That's what Something Just Broke replaced. That's not in the show anymore. The psoriasis song, absolutely.
I did have a question for you, and I've forgotten it. So I feel pretty sad about that.
Was it about the show itself, or was it about Broadway? Was it about social media? I have all the answers about social media.
No, it was not about social media. Oh, well. I won't remember it. That's a fact.
Yeah, facts are facts, and that's a fact. So, yeah, I mean, there's not much else I really want to go into. It's a very short show. This is a 90-minute musical. It's the shortest in all the Sondheim shows. And it's a show that in my brain, I always thought was, like, weirder than it is. And it is a weird musical, but it's one of those things where it's, like, when it's kind of, I don't know, when you lean into the theatricality of it, when you embrace the dark humor of it, it's not as odd as people think. Like, it's definitely one of the most out there concepts for a musical, but when it's performed, I feel like it all kind of
makes sense. Odd at all. Like, it's not weird at all.
Well, I think it's one of those things where, like, you write down like what the musical is in a sentence and you're like, what? That's a musical? In the same way that you go, oh yeah, it's about the last week of Jesus Christ and it's all set to rock music. It's like,
yeah.
That's
exactly.
Yeah, but then you see it and you're like, oh, it all kind of fits. Like it this works.
It slightly departs from the like tropes and formulas that everybody is excited exist in musical theater, mm-hmm. but like it also obeys them as much. And that's why it's a fun show.
Mm.
Like, but there's certainly a million other examples of that in musical theater that like goes to Broadway. Can I name them? No, because I haven't seen enough shows.
You know, that one thing with the people and the stuff, that show. No, there are plenty of examples. We don't need to go through all of them. Let's get into a little bit of the legacy, the aftermath with Assassins, and talk about this for a little bit longer. When Assassins opened in 91, its reviews were kind of not great. It had some pretty good reviews. You know, one critic said it's as horrifying as it is hilarious, which some people have said about My Body. And another critic said nothing quite prepares you for the brilliant work, but the big review that sort of killed the show's chances of transferring. And Sondheim says it wasn't the review. He says, oh, we just, you know, timing wasn't right in finding a theater, but I don't believe him.
Wait, who wrote the review?
Frank Rich in the New York Times.
Okay.
Who was, you know, the most powerful critic at the time. And he was a very big fan of Sondheim. He was like the reason why Sunday in the Park with George ran for 1.5 years because he just kept on writing about it in the Times. And he's like, hey guys, maybe don't go see Cats for a 9th time and go see Sunday in the Park with George. Be better. Just be better. But he didn't like the show. He thought that there were a couple of really great songs, but the thing didn't really come together. He thought it needs to be a little sharper, a little more accurate. And to be fair to him, the original production of Playwrights Horizons really leaned into the fact that it was a review. Like every song had a different set piece. It didn't feel like it came together. And right. It wasn't until it was done 1 year later in London when Sam Mendes kind of had a more unifying vision for it. And they added Something Just Broke and Frank Rich came back to see it. And asshole that he is, and I love him, he's my favorite critic, he was like, it's better. I still don't think it's perfect, but it's better. And that kind of gave them the go ahead of like, okay, so like this is the version of the show we'll be doing like regionally and wherever it gets done again. They were going to bring it to Broadway in 2001 at the Roundabout, and 9/11 occurred that fall, and Roundabout was like, so maybe not the best time for a musical about assassins.
Very much.
So they pushed it back 2 years, and they it opened in 2004 at Studio 54 with some amazing actors. It was right before Neil Patrick Harris became huge again with How I Met Your Mother. So at the time, everybody was like, oh yeah, Doogie, he's trying to be a Broadway dude.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is like you watch, if you ever watch the bootleg of that production, because he's not in the opening number as the balladeer / Lee Harvey Oswald, he pops up for Booth and nobody gives him entrance applause. And it just shows you like where his career was in 2004. We're like a short, you know, 10 years later, he's doing like, you can't murder someone for a ticket to Hedwig. But 10 years earlier, everyone's like, oh yeah, Doogie's here.
Oh, I forgot that he did Hedwig. Where is he now?
Where is he now? I think he's in Harlem with his husband and kids.
Mm.
Yeah. Cool. He's doing all the TV stuff. He was pretty good in Hedwig. John Cameron Mitchell was better, but you know, it's not great to compare artists, Aaron. I don't appreciate you making me do that.
I don't do it.
No. It's, but you know.
I can talk about Bernadette versus Patty all day in Gypsy.
You're talking about Bernadette versus Patty?
Yeah.
I mean, if you want, I have no problem with that. I mean, I feel like in an episode about assassins, people are like, we already listened to the Gypsy episode. Must you talk about assassins? But I have no problem comparing those two women.
I just know Gypsy better than assassins.
Also, Patty loves to compare herself to Bernadette all the time.
Yeah, why not? You know, it's like, what else is there to do? It's COVID-19.
Exactly. The 2004 production is big old hit. It wins 5 Tony Awards, and this is the year of Wicked and Avenue Q, so to win 5 Tony Awards against those two is like hello 12. It's done again in New York with you guys at City Center. I don't know if anyone in this episode realizes this up until now, but you did the show at City Center a few years back. Despite what you say, despite you having very few memories of it, you did do it.
I remember City Center very well.
Yeah, so you can see photos of Aaron online. You can watch some videos of it on YouTube. I was reading the Times review of your production. I believe it was Jesse Green, and he called you like witchy, but like he meant it in a positive way. I can't remember the exact wording, but I just remember the word witchy was in there. I was like, yeah, I guess, because you had that like long cape that was very the witch and Into the Woods.
I'm curious which show he watched, because our dress rehearsal, I also had a wig on, and Anne Kaufman, amazing director of that show, who I loved working with, she called me late at night the night before the show opened, and she was like, how would you feel about not wearing a wig? And I was like, I'd feel pretty great about that. I was like, I already was born with one, so it makes sense. But anyway, that wig was like this crazy bright red, and it.
Right. Those are the photos of you, are that in the bright red wig.
It was like Neo Witch, you know, like, it doesn't matter. No. I'm done talking about that.
Done. Well, did you read the oral history book on Angels in America, The World Only Spins Forward?
I don't think I did.
There's a story with the Broadway production of Angels with George C. Wolfe and Marcia Gay Harden, where they're in previews, and all throughout rehearsals and previews, she has a wig for Harper. And towards the end of previews, George C. Wolfe's like, Marcia, the wig's not working. You're hiding behind the wig, Marcia. And like, expecting her to be like, okay, George, I suppose. But she's like, no, I need the wig. And he's like, it got to the point where it was the performance for like the Times was coming. And like it backstage, you have George C. Wolfe and Marcia Gay Harden like grabbing onto this wig, doing a tug of war. And she's like, I need it. And he's like, no, you don't. So maybe Anne thought like that was going to happen with you. She's like, Aaron, maybe no wig. Expecting you to be like, no, I need it.
Well, the weird part about it is that the way that you're mic'd, which is the most awkward part of being strapped into all this shit is like, it's actually way easier with a wig because they just, I don't know, it just goes in between your hair and the wig and then they just like tape it to your forehead. But if it's just your hair, they have to like wire it through your hair in this weird way and it doesn't look normal and whatever.
It's a great story.
Queen, I saw you dozing off and I was like, there are other people I could talk to where this would be the entire episode and people would live, so it, do not.
I'm just annoyed we didn't talk about your Bernadette versus Patty.
I don't want to talk about it. I want to talk about my hair.
Talk about your hair. No, they are both queens and they both bring respective things to their roles. Any issues I have with Patty's Rose is not a problem I have with Patty. It's a problem I had with that production. You know what I don't have a problem with is your hair.
Let me just say this. Bernadette is June. Not Gypsy.
Well, she's
not Mama Rose.
Well, she's June, you know, all grown up. She's like, she's baby Jane, essentially. Her Rose was a June who never got to be a June. Yeah. There was a lot I liked about her Rose. I felt more watching her, but I would say Patty's performance is more in line of what the role was quote unquote designed to be, but that's neither here nor there. I mean, Assassins is now sort of becoming a staple in the regional theater market, in the, you know, avant-garde theater market. It's becoming less and less of a niche cult show and becoming more of just like a staple, which is interesting. And I like it.
I think it's becoming a staple of the avant-garde theater market.
I didn't mean real avant-garde. I know you know actual avant-garde. I'm talking avant-garde in regards to musical theater, you know?
Okay.
Like, when I say avant-garde, I'm the musical theater girl who's like, I'm the Catholic school girl who's like, guys, I was so slutty last night, he went under my shirt. Like, that is what I mean. I don't mean any of the other stuff. And I've seen some avant-garde theater in my past, and basic hoe that I am, I was like, I don't understand it. I want to listen to more Chorus Line. But that's
just a good show at City Center.
I wish I had seen that, but it wasn't easy to get a ticket.
No, I don't know how I did it.
Well, you know, you're connected. You're offer only.
I'm not connected and I'm not ambitious about those things. So what I'm saying is, if you want a vax, get a vax.
that's what we're saying in this episode. If you want to
I'm not saying that at all. The ethics are too fraught.
Well, by the time this episode comes out, we will all be eligible for a vax. So
I think that's great and I can't wait.
Me neither. I'll see you online. I'll recognize you from the back of the head. I'll go, that's Aaron's hair. Or I'll go, or is that a wig?
Yeah, thank you.
I was watching the Brandy Cinderella with some friends last night via Scener, that app where you can like watch Netflix or something with friends online.
Oh, wow, I haven't tried it yet.
It's fun, but because I'm who I am, and it was like my ninth time probably watching it at this point, the movie opens and it's Whitney Houston in front of the green screen singing Impossible with her big curly hair. And no one says anything and I just go, that's a wig. Just like, and everyone's like, great. Moving on. I was like, it's important to say that's a wig.
Yeah.
Final thoughts on Assassins, Aaron, besides the fact that it's clearly not as avant-garde as the rest of us basic people think it is.
It's not a critique. It's super in the musical theater like canon. That's what I want people to take away from my life, is just that sentence.
Yes.
It's not weird. Actually, yeah. If you're listening to this podcast, you're probably an obsessive musical theater person. Assassins is not that weird, and you need to weird up what you are interested in. And because there's plenty of weird musical theater that is so good that nobody knows about because it's not on Broadway and it's not off Broadway.
Sometimes it's not even in America. It's in a different country.
I don't believe that for a second.
Get educated, people. No, this podcast, it is very musical theater-y. We talk about plays, too. We try to talk about theater in general. This series is Sondheim because, you know, it's just a very flashy name that gets people's attention and people can say, oh, I love Sweeney. I love Night Music. Eventually, I'll be going into other things. But to cut the basic stuff, I cut the musical theater stuff with a lot of gross sex jokes that has kept a lot of mothers from letting their children listen to me talk about why their children need to get educated. They're like, listen, you've got a lot of great stuff to say about Sondheim, but you talk about butt stuff way too much.
I haven't heard you talk about butt stuff even one time.
Well, because I was staying focused. Instead, I was talking about your wig and I was talking about Catholic schoolgirls going under the shirt.
Yeah, all right. I'll take that. That's the Les part of you.
Erin, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about assassins and dealing with my basicery.
Thanks for dealing with my basicery as well about assassins. I
it's the only thing that's basic about you.
Right, more justice. Yeah.
No,
I got to meet Sondheim a couple times.
Any stories there?
I was pretty well, my mom at the like whatever the equivalent of the rap party is, closing night party. My mom
Aaron's from the film world mostly, if you can't tell.
No, I was just said that to please myself, to hope for more money in the future. But my mom went up to Sondheim and was like, oh no, what? Sorry, I know we have to go. But my mom like bumped into Sondheim. That's what happened, with a big plate of food. My parents were like the first people at the party, just like loading up with free snacks and free drinks. Mm-hmm. Bumped into him, dumped a bunch of like pita bread on the floor and was like, oh my gosh, I'm sorry. I'm Squeaky's mom. And then he introduced himself as Stephen Sondheim. And honestly, she got more conversational time with him than I ever did because I was too reverent and frightened.
I would love it if that story ended with Sondheim going to your mom and be like, oh yeah, and this and that and that, and then seeing you and going, should have worn the wig, and then walks away.
should have said no to Anne there, girl.
Keep on wearing that wig. Erin, where can people find you on, I know we just like shat all over it, but where can people find you on social media should you want them to find you?
I'm most active on Instagram, but COVID's made me a little more selective about my time on social media, but I'm most active on Instagram and then on Twitter too, at Erin Markey on Twitter and at Erin _Markey on Instagram.
And if you have an offer for Erin, because Erin's famously offer only.
I am.
you have a website.
I guess I do.
I guess I do. Yes. You can find me on Instagram, y'all, at Matt Koplik, usual spelling. If you like the podcast, listen, I don't like being this needy bitch, but I'm going to be a needy bitch. Like it, review it, subscribe to it, recommend it to friends. The algorithm is real. The more 5-star ratings I get, the more it pops up in other people's searches. And I love being a boutique podcast, but I would totally settle for being a tri-state chain, you know?
Yep. I think that's where it's at. Just I don't want a guy that owns a few McDonald's.
Yeah, but just in Connecticut, New York, and New Jersey. I don't need to go coast to coast. That's a lot. I'm busy.
Mm-mm. There's enough bodies of water in Connecticut.
Exactly. enough bodies of water?
Well, if you're bi-coastal, then you're not about the coast.
I was just like, I was literally thinking of like bodies in water. And then I was thinking actual water. And then I was thinking, wait, how does this work? Coast to coast. Yes, there are enough ponds and lakes in Connecticut that I can say I'm coast to coast.
Yeah. Okay, coast to coast.
Coast to coast. So, Erin, we usually close out every episode with a nice Broadway diva. Lately with the Sondheim stuff, I've tried to keep it relevant to people who are in the show that we've discussed. And I know you're not a Broadway baby, but you mentioned her earlier. So I think we're going to close out with one Miss Annie Golden. How does that sound to you?
That sounds great. You're going to play a song that she sings?
It's going to come in post. So,
okay. I was like, wait, no. You bring her in the room right now?
Annie, get over here, please. I keep her on, I have her on retainer. She's she sits in my bathroom every day until I want her to sing a little something from Assassins or Full Monty. Annie, come on in here, girl. No, yeah, she'll play in post. So when you hear this episode, like 2 months from now, I don't know exactly when this comes out. I guess 2 months from now, you'll hear Annie play in towards the end.
What song is it going to be? Or is that a surprise?
It's a surprise. I don't even know yet. Anyway, guys, thank you so much for listening. Make sure to check in next week, where I believe we will be doing The Frogs. Speaking of a show that Sondheim worked on way before it ever came to Broadway. Friend and alum of the pod, Allie Gordon, will be discussing it with me, as she is one of the few people in this world who actually saw it on Broadway. Anyway, thanks so much for making it through, guys, and catch you next week. Bye!
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.